Hello, Here and Now podcast listeners. It's Robin Young. With a favor to ask, please go to hereandnow.org/survey, all one word, and tell us more about yourself. Our survey takes less than 5 minutes, and your feedback will help us improve the podcast. So go to hereandnow.org/survey and answer a few questions. That's hereandnow.org/survey. Thank you.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President Trump's former campaign chairman, Paul Manafort, stood before a federal judge today to face sentencing for the second time in 2 weeks. Judge Amy Berman Jackson ordered him to serve an additional 43 months in prison. That brings the total to 7.5 years. And now there are new charges of residential mortgage fraud, that is, residential mortgage fraud coming from a Manhattan district attorney. NPR's national justice correspondent Carrie Johnson was at the courthouse in Washington, D.C. for Manafort's sentencing today. Take the last first, Carrie. What do we know about these new charges coming from New York?
These are about 16 charges coming from the Manhattan DA, Cyrus Vance. He accuses Paul Manafort of a year-long residential mortgage fraud scheme through which he falsified business records to illegally obtain millions of dollars. Manafort is now facing state charges in New York in addition to these federal counts.
Okay, now the sentencing today. The federal judge in Virginia gave a 4-year sentence to some criticize as lenient. That was the earlier sentence. Lenient, according to the sentencing guidelines. How did Judge Jackson today decide her sentence?
You know, the tone here by Judge Amy Berman Jackson in Washington, D.C. was very different than the tone last week in Virginia. Jackson said that Paul Manafort was not public enemy number one, but nor was he a victim. She talked about his pattern of spin and dissembling, that he wanted credit for supporting his family, but that he used other people's money to do it. And finally, Lisa, this judge said, "It's all very problematic to me because court is one of the places where facts still matter in this world."
And how is the sentence being viewed? Is it seen as being especially lenient or tough?
Well, you know, a total of 7.5 years is a significant sentence for a white-collar criminal defendant with no prior criminal record, as Paul Manafort is. On its own, the sentence from the judge in Virginia last week raised a lot of eyebrows from criminal defense lawyers. This total of 7.5 years may be more in the range of what they were expecting.
Paul Manafort issued his first apology today in court. He had not assumed any responsibility until now. What did he say?
Manafort spoke from a wheelchair, from a microphone set up at the desk or the court table. He said he was very upset at the cost to his family. He said, "This case has taken everything from me." He's about to turn 70 years old in April. He said, "Please let me be with my wife." But the judge said that Paul Manafort really had the gift of gab, a gift of words, and that he had decided not to write her a letter expressing remorse. Instead, Manafort relied on letters from his wife, from one of his daughters, from his brother and brother-in-law, and a number of longtime family friends. The judge said she really would have wanted to hear more from Manafort himself, and she questioned whether the remorse that he was talking about today in court was really heartfelt. She said, "Saying I'm sorry for being caught is not the same thing as having genuine contrition and remorse."
Carrie, how, if at all, does this sentence inform us on the wider Mueller probe?
You know, there have been a number of charges against a number of people. Many of them have pleaded guilty. Lisa, this sentence of 7.5 years total is the most serious of all. Paul Manafort was the campaign chairman for President Trump's campaign. And while his case, both of these cases in D.C. and Virginia, did not involve allegations of collusion or conspiracy with Russians, that doesn't mean, the judge said today, that those allegations have been proven or disproven. The judge said, "Let's wait and see what this special counsel probe concludes. It's too early to say what the investigation overall has determined because we do not know what special counsel Robert Mueller will say in a final report to the Justice Department."
Okay, final question. What happens to Paul Manafort now?
Paul Manafort is being recommended to serve his time in a prison in Cumberland, Maryland. That's not too far away from Washington, D.C. It's also a place where other prominent white-collar defendants have served time, including the former lobbyist Jack Abramoff. We will see if the Bureau of Prisons decides to send him there.
NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Thanks a lot, Carrie.
My pleasure.
Well, Canada has now joined a number of other countries in closing its airspace to the Boeing 737 MAX 8 and 9 jets following two fatal crashes of the MAX 8 in less than 5 months. But Boeing and the Federal Aviation Administration continue to stand by the planes. Joining us now is Seth Kaplan with Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So Canada's transport minister cited satellite data today that he says shows similarities in the flight patterns of the Ethiopian Airlines plane that crashed over the weekend and the Lion Air plane that crashed last year. A U.S. official says that data is inconclusive. What more do we know?
Yeah, this gets us closer to being able to more precisely compare the two incidents. Earlier this week, Ethiopian Airlines CEO said that the pilot seemed to have flight control problems. So whereas at first we were just talking sort of in broad generalities about two accidents where, yeah, there were issues with the vertical climb, now we do have a few data points suggesting that it might have been something more like what happened with Lion Air, although no specific evidence yet that anti-stall system, which rather clearly contributed to the Lion Air crash, was to blame here.
Do you think it's only a matter of time, though, before the FAA follows Canada here? The fact that many U.S. planes have to cross into Canadian airspace just to get from point A to point B. When I fly from Boston to Chicago, I usually fly over a little part of Canada. Now, if I were on a MAX 8, I wouldn't be able to do that.
Yeah, it's getting to the point where the impact of grounding the rest of the fleet is simply less because so many of these planes are grounded and they're restricted from so much airspace around the world.
So do you think that the FAA is going to follow suit?
Well, this is all unprecedented, Jeremy. It's usually in the past been the FAA that takes the lead in incidents like this, especially when you're talking about Boeing aircraft, Boeing manufactured in the U.S., a U.S.-based company. So it's typically been the FAA that would take action and then other civil aviation authorities around the world following suit. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the European authorities would take the lead with an Airbus aircraft. I think when it comes to Boeing at this point, public perception-wise, this is all very bad for them. This keeps the story in the news. You have the FAA on one hand saying, Boeing, you have to fix this urgently, but on the other hand sort of threading the needle and saying the plane is still safe. Perception-wise, they could make this story go away for a little while by just saying, look, we're going to fix it soon and these planes aren't going to fly. I think from Boeing's perspective, it's probably concerned about taking that stance. Right now, just from a financial standpoint, in the long term, set aside the current public perception, in the long term, it's probably thinking about what kind of compensation it might have to pay to airlines if this thing is grounded. So right now, it can still take the position that this plane is safe to fly. Now, look, I believe that they believe that, and I believe that the FAA believes that. Because the cost of being wrong about that is just so great. Nobody wants to be the person getting that decision wrong. But in terms of why they wouldn't just go ahead and do what would help them now perception-wise, that's probably something else that they have to consider. Right now, their position is the plane is safe. If you don't want to fly it, that's fine, but it's a safe aircraft.
Well, and let's hear about what some pilots are saying. NPR has learned that a number of U.S. pilots who fly the Boeing 737 MAX planes have complained about them in a federal database. Some have reported that the automated system pushed the plane's nose down. Could the problem be more widespread than we know?
That's what it sounds like from those reports. You know, we knew that doomed Lion Air flight, that aircraft had the same problem the previous day. I mean, that's the part of the responsibility that lies at least with the airline there for not taking that plane out of service. These are other pilots saying that at least in more mundane ways, they've had the same issue. This is the anti-stall system, Jeremy, that recall was designed to prevent things that had caused previous accidents, previous high-profile accidents where, planes crashed because a plane was stalling or at least seemed to be stalling, and the pilot, in a panic, seemed to not do what pilots are supposed to do. They do what they did what probably the rest of us would want to do, which is to try to climb. Actually, you're supposed to point the nose down a bit, try to regain airspeed, and then that lifts the plane back up. This anti-stall system was designed to do that automatically, tilt the nose down. With the first Lion Air flight, what seems to have happened is that there were incorrect airspeed readings, so the plane thought it was stalling and tilted the nose down, and that, along with the pilots not figuring out how to override the system mm-hmm. correctly, seems to have caused that crash. The question here is whether this one happened for precisely that reason, but again, at least enough data points, at least enough broad similarities that you have all of these countries and airlines around the world deciding that they're not going to take any chances.
Seth, I took a 737 flight yesterday. It was not a MAX 8. I was happy that it was not a MAX 8. And by the way, I'm the kind of person who, even when the flight gets turbulent, I don't really freak out because I know that's just the way that, that things go. But I see that the website Kayak, the travel website Kayak, is now allowing users to filter its flight search results by aircraft model. Do you expect passengers to start basically voting with their feet and maybe even getting off of planes if they're the MAX 8 and they don't want to fly on them?
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people, Jeremy, right now are paying attention to aircraft type in a way that very few people do. I do. I think you do. But yeah, this is something that people shouldn't have to think about. Personally, if I were scheduled on one, I would get on one. Because I know that I looked at the DO schedule data and there have been 250,000 successful MAX flights so far. Obviously, two doomed ones, that's too many. But, you know, I still feel like getting on a MAX is safer than a lot of other things we do in our lives. But that said, you cannot blame people for doing what they're doing and for wanting to filter out the MAX flights.
That is Seth Kaplan with Airline Weekly. Seth, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And let us know what you think. Would you get on a MAX 8 right now, given what we have seen and all of the pressure that's been building against them? Let's bring in our political strategist for reaction to the Manafort sentencing and more. Simone Sanders, Democratic strategist, is with us. Hi, Simone.
Greetings.
And Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Great to be here.
Okay, so today, a lot of news for Paul Manafort, the former Trump campaign chairman. Another few years in prison for him right now, although he's waiting for a pardon from the president, which may or may not come. But then, after the sentencing, the Manhattan District Attorney indicted Manafort for residential mortgage fraud. This would be pardon proof because they are state charges. Alice, what does this mean for Paul Manafort?
This means that he is not going to see the light of day for a very, very long time, if ever again. And I have to say that justice has been served. And this is a man that has lived in his entire life of greed and opulence and unsavory activity. And I'm glad to see that the Justice Department and the justice system has taken decisive action on this. And even if a pardon does come down the road, it's encouraging to know that the legal system does have provisions to make sure that he continues to suffer and pay the consequences of his actions.
Well, Simone, what do you think this means? And do you think that the fact that maybe he's not going to be able to be pardoned, I mean, assuming the process moves forward as it is, and maybe he's convicted of these charges, that may make him cooperate more with Mueller?
Well, perhaps. You know, Trump has a long history with Paul Manafort. As everyone knows, he was a key member of Trump's inner circle in 2016, played a very important role in his campaign. So he can, Paul Manafort can still be pardoned for the federal crimes. Now, depending on what happens with the Manhattan DA, that is, in fact, something entirely different. So I think there is a factor. Look, Paul Manafort is an older gentleman. He pleaded in court today. I was talking with reporters that were in the courtroom. He pleaded in court and said, you know, he wanted to live out the rest of his days with his wife. He didn't want to be separated from his wife. But I think that this is a case study in the inequities, actually, in the criminal justice system. And, you know, just last year, there was a woman who erroneously voted in Texas that got more time than Paul Manafort did last week and this week combined. And so I think this just goes to show that criminal justice reform is absolutely needed, and white-collar crimes are definitely treated differently than other crimes throughout the country.
I want to talk about impeachment a little bit. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told the Washington Post that she is not for impeaching the president. It's not worth it, she said. I wonder how rancorous this issue is inside the party, Simone.
Yeah, you know, it's no secret that there are lots of grassroots groups in the Democratic Party that make up, that fuel the oil that is that fuel the machine that is the Democratic Party apparatus, that believe the president has engaged in misconduct that could be an impeachable offense. Now, I want to remind folks that an impeachable offense, someone once said, is anything that the House of Representatives decides it is at any given point in time in history. I think what you heard from Speaker Pelosi in the interview with the Washington Post was not anything much different than what she has previously said. said. The rest of that quote, she goes on to talk about if they're waiting to hear what the Mueller investigation turns up, waiting to see if there is, in fact, something that would absolutely hamper folks on Capitol Hill, both Democrats and Republicans, to the point where they have to act because it is their duty to exercise oversight. Should she have, is the grassroots happy with the language Speaker Pelosi used, though? I would venture to say no.
I think the key takeaway in her comments with regard to that is that, in her view, she may be giving other Democrats cover by saying it's just simply not worth it, even though they can make the efforts to go after the president. And they can say, well, House Speaker Pelosi is recommending against it. But the key word in her comments there was, unless there's something compelling, overwhelming, and bipartisan. Bipartisan is the key. You're going to be very hard-pressed to find Republicans that will go along with any kind of impeachment actions, given certainly their support for the president, and not the least of which the frustration and the divide it will cause in this country. So trying to get bipartisan support for any kind of proceedings like that will be next to impossible.
I mean, I'd just like to note, Alice is absolutely right. But impeachment is a mechanism that is built into the fabric of our country. It is a way in which Congress is supposed to hold the president accountable. And so one could argue, and I think many grassroots and progressive folks are arguing, that it's not about what is popular. It's not about if it's bipartisan. It's about what's right in terms of oversight. So we'll see what happens.
Alice is a Republican strategist. I wonder if you can tell us if you think Republicans are being hypocritical then when they brush off allegations of lies and hush money and payments and obstruction of justice surrounding President Trump after they impeached President Clinton.
There is some hypocrisy. You can't deny that. But at the end of the day, what we're looking at right now are allegations. We have not proven that. The key with the hush money payments for women, it certainly doesn't sit well with a lot of evangelicals, but in terms of it being something that is proven to be a campaign finance violation, which is the more serious concern from a legislative and political and a voter standpoint, we haven't met that threshold yet. So until that turns out to be the case, Republicans are right to continue to stand firm on their position that it's certainly not an impeachable offense and actions that this president has done. It might be uncomfortable for many to listen to and to understand and explain to their children. But in terms of it being something that's impeachable, it's not there yet.
Okay, let's talk about 2020, because there's a lot of news in that race this week, starting with the person who seems to be rising to the top of the conversation right now, and that would be Joe Biden, the former vice president. He spoke yesterday to the International Association of Firefighters. Now, remember, he's not a candidate yet for president, but he sounded like one. Here he is talking about the 9/11 attacks.
It sent a signal to the world. You can knock us down, but you can never beat us. Never, never, never beat us. Think about it. You know?
They're saying, run, Joe, run. You can hear them cheering. Simone, what will it mean if Biden gets into the race, and do you think he will?
It means that there will be yet another candidate who believes they should be the Democratic nominee and the next president of the United States of America. Look, I think Vice President Joe Biden will get in. I think there are a lot of signs that are leaning that way. I think there's a lot of folks that would love to see him in the race. And if the vice president enters the race, he will, in fact, be a formidable candidate. But with so many folks in the race, with not a clear, I'm somebody that believes that there is not actually a clear front runner. There are folks that have high name ID, but it's still too early to tell. So with so many folks in the race, it will be very important to hit the ground running for all of the candidates to make their case directly to the people, not just in the first four states, but in places like Jackson, Mississippi, where you saw Senator Kamala Harris yesterday, and I do believe Senator Warren going on Monday, and places all across the country. And the first debates, I think, is where we will get to see where the chips are actually mm-hmm. falling and how the candidates are shaking.
And Alice, there's another candidate who's not in the race that I just want to ask you. Does Beto O'Rourke, the former Texas congressman, scare you as a candidate in 2020 if he gets in?
Not from a general election standpoint. Look, Beto O'Rourke and many of these other candidates that are in are hook, line, and sinker the typecast of a Democratic candidate for the primary. We have Biden out front by 7 points in the polling averages, ahead of Sanders, Harris, Warren, Booker, O'Rourke, Klobuchar, and the others. But what we have here is a field of candidates that are so far left that it's going to be a battle for the left in order to win the primary. But their goal, and if I was advising Democrats, which I certainly would not, they need to find someone that will actually win the general as well. And I think someone like Biden, being a more moderate candidate, would be more successful. Look, right now we're all looking at who can battle it out to win the Democratic primary, but the general election candidate and finding the right person to be that person is the real challenge. I think O'Rourke is a strong candidate. He did a fantastic job in Texas against Senator Cruz. But at the end of the day, he can't just be the Democratic candidate to win the nomination. They have to be a more moderating voice to win a general.
Look, I'd like to remind folks that in 2016, the difference between Donald Trump being president and Hillary Clinton being president was 100,000 votes across Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. 100,000 votes. In 2018, in the midterm elections, Democrats did very well in Michigan, Wisconsin, and a little, you know, we did a little bit better. We have some work still to do in Pennsylvania. So I am someone that believes that the 2020 presidential race, regardless of who the Democratic nominee is, that person and Democrats in the general election will have to be laser focused on being authentic with their message, but also speaking directly to the base. Things like health care, things like protecting Medicare and Medicaid, Social Security, those are things that some people might call radical, but everyday regular American people, places like Omaha, Nebraska, where I'm from, think are pretty important. And so if you are able to speak directly to the base, if you campaign everywhere and close the margins in some places like Appalachia, where they might not really break for the Democratic candidate, but you have to go out there and close the margins. I think Democrats could be successful in the 2020 general election.
It would also be helpful if the Democrats learned a lesson from 2016 that presidential candidates and presidential races are won by electoral college and not by popular vote. Note to the Democratic Party, campaign an electoral college campaign, and it's certainly a much more winning strategy than popular vote.
We should say
I want folks to campaign everywhere, everywhere.
The former House Speaker Paul Ryan said that some Democrats could indeed beat Donald Trump in 2020 if Trump wins on personality alone. Alice, what do you think?
Trump, I think, has a tremendous chance regardless of who the candidate is. The economy's good. He's popular. He just has to broaden his base quite a bit, and he has the power of the incumbency, which goes a long way to beating someone that doesn't have that advantage.
That is Alice Stewart, a Republican strategist, and Simone Sanders, a Democratic strategist from Omaha, Nebraska, just like Warren Buffett, not quite as rich. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
The investigation into the Boeing jet crash in Ethiopia on Sunday continues. Meanwhile, people on two continents are mourning the death of one particular passenger, a writer with sharp intellect who found humor in the most grim subject, and often that subject was his home country, Nigeria. The man was Pius Adesanme. He is a writer and professor at Carleton University in Ottawa, Canada. His longtime friend and novelist, Oke Ndibe, is based in Hartford, Connecticut. He says that one of Adesanme's favorite targets was the older generation of mediocre leaders in Africa who won't let go of power.
Pius would take on the obsession by many, many Nigerians, what we call the geriatric class. Men and women who have little education, but who nevertheless present themselves to head the political destiny of a country which has the largest population in Africa. So Pius always found it ironic and a paradox that in a country with some of the best intellects in the world, some of the best writers and intellectuals and scientists and medical doctors and surgeons, that would always settle for mediocrity when it came to our political leadership.
This came out as well after he had a very serious car accident last year. Tell us what happened and how this points to what you were just saying.
Well, Pius was traveling within Nigeria and had a terrible accident in which one person died. And there's this culture in Nigeria that if you helped victims of accidents, the police would actually sometimes arrest you and make it your responsibility. So people would typically move on at the scene of an accident. And so he wrote about having to scream for help before some good Samaritan took him to the hospital. And yet when they got to the hospital, it took quite a while, several hours, before a doctor could attend to them.
So he turned this own tragedy into kind of a political commentary. He gave a TEDx talk in 2015. We're going to play a little bit of that TED talk now.
Human agency is fundamental, so that in this culture, in this worldview, everything you do is supposed to enhance the instrumentality, the life, reinforce it, the centrality of agency, the human. So when we're talking of all these African concepts, Ubuntu, togetherness, community, and all that, fundamentally we're talking about human agency.
You can hear what a forceful person he was in that.
Yes.
But what's the larger concept of what he's saying?
Well, in Africa, you find lots of young people, especially because in most countries in Africa, the population is young. You see from the creativity in the musical sector, in literary activities, even in enterprise, that the young people are ready and willing to go. But they are held in a vice by the geriatric class that has occupied the top levels of the political space. And so Pius was deeply concerned about this absence of actions that would facilitate the flowering of this creative agency in young people especially, or what he calls broadly the African humanity.
Well, thank you very much for telling us about your friend and colleague, Oke Ndibe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
Okay, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Jose Galvan is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He's with us once again. Hi, Jose.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. And looking at the music that you brought us today, it looks like we're going to be taking a trip around the world.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, good. So let's start things off where there's a big international airport. You can fly almost anywhere you want to go, and that would be where you are, Los Angeles. This is a band called Triangle Fire. This is Little Ferns. I like that. Tell us more about why you picked this one.
Well, these guys, they're a group of young kids out of L.A., sort of the east side and like Highland Park, which is kind of northeast mm-hmm. of L.A. But their sound is just so mature, and it harkens back to that to that Laurel Canyon vibe, and get a little bit of Fleetwood Mac in there, minus the female vocals. They self-recorded, and they just paid tribute sort of with like these huge guitar riffs and these mm-hmm. echoey sounds.
They say on their Facebook page that they want to drive their Toyota truck into your heart.
Yes, correct. And if you're wondering if their name is a reference to the Shirtwaist Fire, that tragedy of 1911, it is. Uh-huh. Super random industrial reference, but great name for a band, I think.
Okay, well, the next one that you have brought us is Down Under in Australia. This is called Only You. It's by Death Bells.
Yeah.
So is there a big punk scene in Australia?
There actually is, and Sydney is where Death Bells is from. And these are guys that came out of that scene and wanted something a little more refined and wanted that 80s nostalgia. So as you can hear, the drums are just large, right? You got the reverb vocals, and then prominent bass lines are basically what built most of their songs. This one has that meandering like guitar riff that's sort of indicative of like hardcore post-punk, and I'm a sucker for that. So,
and tell me what you mean by a little more refined.
They wanted more melodies. They wanted song structure and not just, you know, punk. The Sydney punk scene is just straight ahead punk, like as it happens in the UK now. A lot of these countries are sort of mimicking what was maybe like mid-80s here in the States with like Social Distortion, Scream, bands like that.
Okay, the next one that you've brought us comes from Japan. This is Dripping Sun. It's by Kikigaku Moyo, which means geometric patterns.
Correct.
We should say that this song goes on for nearly 8 minutes. It gets more and more psychedelic. Tell us more about it.
It definitely long songs. Their album, Masana Temples, released early last year, just kind of went under the radar. They've hit all the psych scenes, the festivals in L.A., Austin. I love the tempo changes. I love those guitar riffs. There's a lot of psychedelia out in Japan, which I did not know of until I started researching. Yeah. And the cool part is they, like, the music obviously translates.
And they recorded this song in Lisbon, Portugal?
Yeah, they travel a lot. They work with different producers. You still kind of feel the vibes. They sing in Japanese.
Okay, well, next, let's go back to the Western Hemisphere. This is by the Mexican artists Jimena Sariana. This is called Que Tiene, which translates to What's Wrong With It.
A veces cuando la luz atraviesa temprano por la ventana entra el sol y tú llegas buscándome. Estás intentando convencerme. No sé si esto me conviene. Vale madre lo que diga. Si no sé frenar, ¿qué tienes si no sé bailar? ¿Qué tienes si no tengo flow? ¿Qué tiene? ¿Qué tiene? ¿Qué tiene si no sé frenar? Si no sé bailar, ¿qué tiene si hoy amanece? ¿Qué tiene? ¿Qué tiene? ¿Qué tiene?
Tell us more about Jimena Sariana.
Jimena was a child actress who decided to start a solo singing career. Her dad's a pretty prominent film and like commercial director. But she's kind of gone after that pop vibe, which is sort of, you know, roller coastered for her on her last albums. Her debut, Mediocre, was nominated for a Grammy, and now she's sort of taking more tropical twist, as is the whole Latin kind of music scene with, you know, like J Balvin and Bad Bunny. But she doesn't go as hardcore as they do. She did a remix with Dylan Francis last year that I think sort of influenced this new album, which, as I said, gets more sort of urban-ish tropical.
And you, by the way, grew up both in Mexico City and Los Angeles. Do you stay in touch with all the music coming out of Mexico?
I try to as much as I can. That's sort of my passion is kind of, there's a lot of stuff going on down there in terms of like indie rock, alternative, electronica, hip hop that sounds like anything in English, but is just in Spanish.
Okay, the last stop on our tour of the world is to a little island off the coast of West Africa. This is from Cape Verde. This is Myra Andrade with Tan Kalakatan.
Bubaka kaka Buris dangong Buapokan Kantun chikaka sang kong 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 kong
Now, I've never been to Cape Verde, but you can hear in this both the African influence and also, obviously, the Portuguese that we're hearing there.
Correct. And my Rose, actually, she traveled a lot as a kid. She was born in Cuba. Her parents moved around, and their hometown is Cape Verde. So she sort of went back to her roots. She was pretty big in the Parisian scene at one point in the early 2000s with a couple random songs that, you know, they gravitated to. They obviously don't speak Portuguese, but I think Europe sort of allows for singers and artists to kind of blend more languages than kind of the States does.
And we noticed that two of the artists that you have brought us today have connections to Portugal.
Yeah, strangely enough. Maybe we need to get down there and see what is going on.
Get over there right away.
Yeah.
Jose Galvan, a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. Thanks as always.
Thank you so much, Jeremy. Always a pleasure.
And you can find all our DJ session picks on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
California Governor Gavin Newsom has granted a reprieve to the state's 737 inmates on death row.
What we're being tasked to do in California is to consider executing more people than any state in modern American history. That's a choice we can make, or we can make, I think, a more enlightened choice.
Newsom signed an order this morning to ban capital punishment in California, and not everybody's happy about it. Michelle Hannessy is president of the Association of Deputy District Attorneys in Los Angeles. Good to speak with you, Michelle.
Nice to speak to you as well.
So 3 years ago, voters decided to ensure the death penalty remains the law of the land in California, and that the process be sped up, in fact. Do you think the governor, through his action today, is making a mistake?
Well, I think what he's doing, if it's done the way the media has been reporting, is going to be legally challengeable because it violates the laws passed by the voters through Proposition 66, which is the initiative process. And he can't just do an end run around laws passed by the voters.
So this is a vote that, as we said, took place in 2016. Can you explain why you think it is that Californians have voted in favor of the death penalty in a very blue state and at a time when the death penalty itself is on the decline across the country? I realize you say that what he's doing may be actionable. On the other hand, it seems consistent with what we're told people in the state are feeling.
It's not consistent, though, when Californians have always voted to keep the death penalty every single time the issue has been put before them. Since Rose Byrd was ousted from the Supreme Court and the voters at that time put a ballot initiative forth to reinstate the death penalty and, in fact, did so, what it comes down to, I think, every time is although California may be a blue state, the citizens of this state are well aware of the effects crimes have on the citizens, especially these, which are the most heinous of crimes. And make no mistake, the people on California's death row are truly evil killers, including a lot of serial killers and killers of children.
And California reinstated the death penalty in 1978, but only 13 people have been executed. Nobody has been put to death there since 2006. So the system for which the governor signed a moratorium today, is that system even functioning as it is? Is this a system that you think is working and should keep working?
Well, Prop 66 was intended to fix that dysfunctional system and was moving towards doing so. There was a legal challenge to Proposition 66, which was denied by the Supreme Court of California. And the only remaining thing stopping executions is a stay in federal court that was imposed on the three-drug protocol, which California no longer has. California switched to a single-drug protocol.
This is for lethal injection, we should say.
Yes. So as recently as about a month or two ago, several district attorneys across the state filed challenges to that stay in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. So there was ongoing litigation that would have lifted the very, very last impediment to performing executions.
Which is one of the reasons the governor decided that he wanted this moratorium in place right now. He has long been against the death penalty. But let me ask you this. There are appeals, which are extremely costly. The process of keeping someone on death row in California has cost the state $5 billion since 1979. The appeals process is there for a reason, because sometimes juries get it wrong. The National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty says that since 1970s, more than 150 people who are on death row have been exonerated, and the governor says capital punishment is inherently unfair because it's applied more often to people of color and those people with mental disabilities. Do you agree with that?
I don't necessarily agree with all of those very sweeping, very generalized statements that are also based on things that happened outside California in different states with different appellate and court processes. You can't just call California's system unfair because of what occurs in another state, because we don't have the same system.
But it also doesn't mean it's inherently fair.
Every single death verdict imposed in the state of California is imposed not by a police officer or a prosecutor. Death verdicts can only be imposed by juries made up of the citizens of our community after they've heard not only all of the evidence of guilt, but additionally they hear any evidence the defense wants to present to prove either their innocence or mitigation, mental retardation, bad childhood, really anything the defense wants can be put before the jury. And it's only after hearing about every single thing the defense wants them to hear about does the jury make a decision on the penalty, whether it should be life or death.
Right. And sometimes they get it wrong. We know that as a fact, and many people have been exonerated because of that. Is capital punishment, do you think, worth it if someone, even one person, is wrongly put to death?
Well, I guess the question, it comes down to a philosophical question, is does the system have to be 100% perfect to be valid? And I think that you would find a different opinion from the victims of crime, the family members of those that have been murdered. In cases where there's absolutely no question of guilt, that those killers absolutely deserve this penalty.
Michelle Hennessy is president of the Association of Deputy District Attorneys in Los Angeles. Nice to speak with you.
Thanks so much.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.